Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. So, today we are in the middle of Sukkot, and that's why we had a beautiful Hallel service, which I just love. It's so wonderful. And of course, it's a longer service because we have that extra 15 minutes there and whatnot. So, I'm going to take what I have in my message today and bring it into two parts. So this part in the next month will come up in the second part, but I do have some things that I want to share with you this morning. I love Sukkot. It's probably my favorite of the holy days because it's a time of joy. You know, Sukkot is a time of joy. And as you know, I've been doing a series over the next few months on the first of the month on inner healing prayer over the next few months leading up through January. And so we'll have a message that, you know, picks up on a theme in inner healing and then moves into the healing service that we'll have after Oneg today. And last time, we talked about healing our image of God and the things that keep us from knowing God in a more intimate way. And so today I want to talk about healing our identity, kind of going like a little step deeper. And, you know, this is like the core of inner healing, and we're going to get into that more, but it's such a big topic. It really is. So I'm just going to scratch the surface today. But, and then if anything comes up or whatever, we'll have an opportunity to spend some time in prayer afterwards. Now, identity is a Sukkot theme. It's a theme of Sukkot. Sukkot is a time of remembering who we are. We remember what God did for us in the desert. We might say that the Sukkah calls us back to the basic and simple truth of who God is and who we are. We might say that the Sukkah strips away the things that we might draw our sense of security from, the things that might draw our sense of identity from, our houses, you know, our material comforts, our successes, our failures, the approval received from others, the hurts, the rejections, the disappointments, the loss. The Sukkah, it like calls you back to the real you. That's the idea. It calls you back to the real you. And there's joy in the Sukkah because there's joy when we know who we are. So we're going to, so to speak, get into the Sukkah this morning and look for that joy. I want to share a profound and intellectual saying with you. Be who you is. Because if you ain't who you is who you ain't. Do you get that? Be who you is, because if you is who... Be who you is, because if you ain't who you is who you ain't. It's pretty profound, isn't it? How many of you have felt that way? How many of you have felt that way before? Everyone in the back row there, I have. It's sort of like, you know, you is who you ain't. You know, it's like an identity crisis. I don't feel like I know myself. I don't know why I'm here. Have any of you felt like that? You know, many of us travel around the world to find ourselves. We go to India to find ourselves, you know, and to find who we are down deep, you know, of course. We don't realize that we're really right where we are, wherever we travel. No matter where we are, finding who we are, the core of ourselves, it seems very difficult to grasp, I think. And we know that there's something there. It's like there's something underneath all the layers, you know. If only we could touch it. If only other people could see it in us. So to break this down, again, this is sort of an overview. I want to introduce a few terms that sort of float around in psychology and self-help books and whatnot today. The concept of the true self and the false self. Now, these terms became popular in psychology, specifically psychoanalysis, back in the 1960s. But since then, they've been used in a number of different contexts and a number of different ways, and I'm not going to be using them in the clinical sense. Sometimes the true self is called the authentic self, or the original self, and the false self is called the pseudo-self, or the imposter. See? So here's a basic overview of how I understand these things used today, like if you Wikipedia them or something like that. The true self, or the authentic self, is the core of who you really are. Not what people tell you you should be or how others might define you. It's the real you underneath all the stuff. If our true self becomes damaged in some way, what happens is we might create a false self around us. And the false self is this protective identity. It's like a mask, which we might feel like is very real. And we create this mask to hide from the insecure and damaged part of ourselves. We create this mask to hide feelings of shame and to hide abandonment and rejection, feeling unworthy. And it protects us from these painful feelings. And it also keeps other people from seeing those feelings inside of us, you see? Now, the false self covers the emptiness we might feel inside when we no longer know who we are. So then we have a question. Who is the real you? What defines your true self? And I love psychology, but I think this is where psychology ends. You know, it does a great job to break these things down, but it doesn't answer that question. Is your true self your real feelings? Is it how you feel in a particular moment? If you feel hurt or shame, is that your true self? If you feel like you have to put on a face to cover up what you really feel inside when you're with other people, where is your true self in that? I want to suggest that from a faith perspective, the true self is more than just like a fleeting and intangible feeling that's too deep to grasp, except for when the birds are chirping on a nice spring day, you know, and then you feel it inside. It's more than your real feelings. It's underneath. It's underneath your hurts. It's underneath the rejections. It's underneath the emotions. It's the deepest part of you, where you draw your sense of identity from. And our real identity is rooted in who God is and who He created us to be. Now, we might say, well, no one really lives out of their true self. And that's probably true. You know, we all go back and forth here. But there's one person who did. Yeshua, didn't he? He came, remember, fully a man, not God pretending to be a man, right? But as a man to show us what we can be as men and women through the power of God. So let's look to him to see what a true self might look like. I want to look at John 13. I'll just read it here. It's a beautiful passage. It was just before the Passover festival. Yeshua knew that the hour had come for him to leave this world and to go to the Father. Having loved his own who were in the world, he now loved them even to the end. Yeshua knew that the Father had put all things under his power and that he had come from God and was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, he took off his outer clothing and wrapped a towel around his waist. And after that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. I think it's a beautiful passage. It connects us to Passover, all these things. But it's a beautiful way for God to show and to demonstrate his heart for us. But I want to focus on verse 3. Yeshua knew that the Father had put all things under his power, that he had come from God, and that he was returning to God. So Yeshua knows these three things. One, that he came from God. Two, that he is returning to God. And three, that the Father has put all things under his power. And it's because he knew those three things that then he was able to humble himself, to wash his disciples' feet, and then go to experience the most painful death a man could imagine for the greatest healing of the world. So I want you to ask yourselves these three questions. Do you know these three things inside of yourself? And I'm not just saying intellectually, but in your heart. Do you know them? Do you know that you came from God? All the way back to conception. That even before you were conceived, you were called, it says, called by name. That you were knit together in your mother's womb and placed in this world at this exact time in history for a great purpose in the kingdom of God. Do you know that? Do you know that you're returning to him? That you're his? That no matter what happens, even through death itself, you're heading to be with him. And do you know that the Father has put all things in your life under his power. That God has everything in his control in the end. That he's more than that, he's empowered and equipped you and given you everything that you need to live out the purpose that he's called you for. And if you know these things, then you know your identity. And when you live out of these things, then you're living out of your true self. Do you see how that takes the fear and the paralysis out of life? You know, to know that he will use you, to know that he'll speak through you, that he'll help you, that he'll guide you, to know that he loves you, to know that you have nothing to fear, to know that there's nothing to be anxious about. Nothing. There's nothing to be anxious about. There's no one to please but your heavenly Abba, and he's already pleased with you. And when we step into our truest self in him, that's when he can start to use us. And that's when we can begin to love like he loves and to live the lives that he would have us live. Created by God, birthed by God, purposed by God, sent by God, returning to God. A beautiful line Judith McNutt said, "My true self lies in my heavenly Abba. My true identity is in my heavenly Father's arms." This is like the core of everything. So what happened? I think that I'm going to be speaking from my own experience here and maybe some generalizations. You know, we're all in different places, but that there's a separation inside of ourselves. And I don't want to be overly simplistic. And again, this is just like a superficial sort of overlook. But I think we need to unpack this from the very beginning. So we're made in the image of God. And we're designed, I would suggest, to draw our identity from God. So if we go back to our great parents, Adam and Eve, what was the first thing they did when they ate that fruit? You know, for the first time, it says that they felt naked, and then they hid from God. So I want to suggest that what happened there was that shame was introduced into the human heart. And not so much, I don't think, as a punishment, but rather as a consequence. They were disconnected from that intimate relationship with God, who was supposed to be the source of their value, the source of their identity, the source of their purpose. But they no longer knew those things. Now, I think it's a mistake that we interpret the idea of, you know, Christian theology as this idea of original sin to mean that we're now inherently bad with no good in us. And Judaism doesn't see it like that. We're the only ones in creation to be called very good. Like the crown of creation, you see? It isn't that what God called very good became bad, but it's that we became broken. And Yeshua is the one trying to put us back together. So we're so very good. We're so very important. You're so very important. But when our hearts are not filled with the love of our heavenly Abba, they become filled with shame. And then so many of us experience all kinds of things that then reinforce this shame in our lives. We get hurt, we are rejected, we are abused, abandoned, condemned, we compare ourselves with others. All these things that we go through. And next time I'll get more into that. But what happens is that shame distorts the image of who we really are, our true self. It like distorts it so we can't see it. And then we begin to draw our identity from that distorted image that we have of ourselves rather than the true image, which is still there. And so often it hurts. It hurts so much that we hide, just like Adam and Eve. Maybe we hide from God. Maybe we hide from others in our lives. We hide from ourselves. You know, we hide from a gnawing sense of rejection or condemnation, a deep loneliness, a sad numbness somewhere in our soul that we can't touch. It's so deep we can't touch it. We hardly even experience it except at the very quiet times. And soon we start living out of a false self. And it hurts too much to live in that broken identity. It hurts. And so we find all kinds of other things to draw our identity from. But underneath that, we know it isn't us. Someone who's done all these crimes, and you talk to them, you know, if only they could see who I really was, you know. If only they could see. But there's a disconnect. We know on the one side that internally we deserve to have tremendous value. Again, I'm speaking from my own experience, sort of putting it generally. And at the same time, we desperately want people to see that in us, yet at the same time, in the deepest places within ourselves, we feel that shame. So we might feel like we have no value or that we're worthless at the same time. This is kind of deep, but you hear people saying things like, everything seems just perfect in my life on the outside. I don't know why I feel so empty on the inside. I feel like I'm living a lie. I don't deserve to feel this way. But instead of looking inward or upward, right, they get a new sports car or a new job or a new wife or a new wardrobe or a new smartphone or a new tie, whatever. And maybe this new thing will fill or at least cover the emptiness that I feel inside. So we live out of fear of rejection, always craving praise and approval of others sometimes. Sometimes we draw our identity from what other people think. It's called people-pleasing. Desperately, we want to belong. We all want to belong. Isn't that true? But inside, we feel like we don't belong, maybe. Rejected or abandoned or lonely. I think this is the root of perfectionism. If I do something perfectly well, then I'll be accepted and approved of. And then we can put that on other people, too. Or sometimes someone might just drown these emotions. You know, that's where addictions come from. Drinking, drugs, partying, sex, pornography, shopping, Facebook. How many likes I get on Facebook, you know. But this is the heart of rebellion, I think. When a teenager rebels or whatever, rebellion isn't evil, it's shame. Shame leads to bitterness, which leads to rebellion. And it's this disconnect. Somewhere deep in us, we know that we're worthy, but we don't feel like it, so we feel cheated. So we get angry at God and whoever has hurt us the most in our lives, or at least we feel that's hurt us. And then we act out and we destroy our bodies and we decide that we deserve all the self-serving pleasures that this world could offer our hearts. And again, next time we'll go more deeper into some of the actual causes of what can do this. But what's most important, what I want us to just take away from here, is that if we don't know who we are, it's because we don't know whose we are. Until we encounter Yeshua, who's the face of God's love, and we allow him to bring healing to our true selves. Because he comes and he sees us for who we really are. I want you to imagine this. Look into his eyes. Just imagine. Look into his eyes. See the love that he has for you. He sees you beyond the cover-up, beyond the pleasing, beyond the perfectionism, beyond the rejection, beyond the loneliness, beyond the pain, beyond the hurts, beyond the resentments. He sees you. He sees the real you. And he just loves you. He just loves you. When you look at the mirror, what do you see? A while ago, we were praying with a woman who had been through awful childhood abuse, and that had led to all kinds of, you know, depression and suicide attempts and all things. And during the session, we asked her what she sees when she looks in the mirror, and she said, "I don't have a mirror." Because inside that place that's supposed to be filled with joy and life and spontaneity and happiness was densely covered over in fear and self-hatred and a sea of darkness. A sea of darkness covering that true self. It's so often in the case of those kinds of things. But in prayer, Yeshua began ever so gently and ever so sweetly to speak to her in that darkness. That he saw her. That he knew her, that she belonged. Like like a growing flame that warms the cold darkness away, kind of comes right into it. And you know, now she's gotten a mirror and she's written scripture verses, "You're fearfully and wonderfully made, you're my child, you're my daughter," all over the mirror. It's the beginning of a healing. It's the beginning. What do you see when you look at yourself in the mirror? Beneath all of the stuff. You know, when I'm talking about this, I put some of this material together for the 20s conference that we had. And it's a harder topic for me to talk about, just to be vulnerable with you a little bit, because it's something that God's really bringing me through over this season. And so it's whenever I'm like putting this together, even this for this talk, there's like a thing that I go through. And so I started to feel anxiety and some things around even this message here. And I just wanted to share that this is totally spontaneous. It's not even in my notes, but just something that happened to me this morning along these lines. Because I think it's time to get real. You know what I mean? And this is real. This is real. And I was feeling like I couldn't give this stuff and talk about it, because it's like he's working me through it, and usually you don't want to like teach about things that you're going through. But one time when I was talking to Rain about that before the conference, she was like, "Well, that's why he wants you to do it. It's because you're going through it." So, but I was feeling those things, and I went down this morning and spent about an hour in prayer before coming here to get ready, and I felt him say, "I've given you this to teach on. I'll help you. You see, I've already done it." And again, I want to qualify. It's not like I'm hearing, you know, the voice from heaven, you know, in my prayer room. It's more like an impression that he gives me. And so I choose to trust and go with that. But that's what I'm experiencing. And you know what I felt inside? I said, "I don't believe it." Intellectually, I believe it. You know, I know these things. I talk about them. I read them. I didn't believe it. Why? Why? What's beneath that? And so I asked him, "Why would you want to do that? Why would you help me?" See, and this is like a bigger context. Why? And I felt him say, "Because I love you." I said, "Don't you see that the things you're teaching about are true for you?" All right, and I said, "What? Really? Why is it so hard for you to believe?" And I said, "Because I feel unworthy." And he said to me, "You are worthy." I said, "No." He said, "Yes." I said, "No." He said, "Yes." I said, "No." He said, "Yes, Nathan." "Really?" "You are worthy." I said, "I can't believe it." He said, "Yes, you can." And he said, "I'll show you." "You'll show me?" "Yes, I'll show you." "Can you say it?" I said, "No. I can't say it because I feel like I'll be proud." I said, "You're not proud. You're speaking what I'm telling you to say." "Really?" "Yes." "I'm worthy." You see, and then I wrote it in my journal. Look, see, I'm worthy. It's wonderful. There's so much freedom and joy in this. There's so much freedom. You see? And whenever we feel like we're not worthy, it's not from God. We feel like, you know, we're becoming prideful. When we feel like we're not worthy, that's pride. That's where the pride comes in. That's where we have to create a false identity around ourselves so that we have to, you know, do all these things and make ourselves look good. And that's pride. But the reason why we're worthy, and I'm saying this to all of us, is not because of what we've done, but it's because of what he's done. He made me worthy. And he made you worthy. Have you heard of, you know, Michelangelo? I'll close with this here. He would carve statues, and like, you know, David, these wonderful statues. And he explained how he would do this. It said, "In every block of marble, uncut marble, I see a statue as plain as though it stood before me, shaped and perfect in attitude and action. I have only to hew away at the rough walls that imprison the lovely apparition to reveal it to others' eyes as mine see it." Isn't that beautiful? So he would look at a marble and he'd say, "I don't see marble, I see Moses in there, and I'm going to lead him out." And then he'd craft these beautiful statues, you know. But he carved these other statues that were called prisoners or captives. And it was a person that, they're beautiful, you can Google them and you can see, a person that was like half beautifully carved out in, you know, perfect. But then the rest was still cut in that marble, like trying to get out, trying to escape from the marble. And I think in a way, this is how God sees us. Created by him, fashioned in the womb, wondrously made, beautiful, in his own image, you see? More beautiful than anything in creation. I mean, you're the crown of creation. Think of the most beautiful thing you can think of. You're more beautiful to him than that sunset, than the ocean, than the bird. But he recognizes that maybe we're trapped under the uncut stone. He doesn't see you as the world sees you, or maybe as you see yourself. He sees you right now, sitting here now, as the person you will become in the kingdom of heaven. And he wants to pull you from inside that block of marble to hold you in his arms. So I want to encourage all of us to come to the service we'll have after Oneg. And what I'll be doing in that is guiding us through a series of kind of neat prayers that will help create a space for God to speak to you and me about the real you and the real me. It's a space to allow Yeshua to come in and just to be more fully a part of who you are at the core. And it's one thing for me to say that the core of your identity is created by God in love, called by name, purposed by him, returning to him, that all things are under his power. It's one thing to say it, but really the healing here, and you have to hear this, the healing is when we hear it from him. And like Sukkot, this kind of deeper healing is about joy. It comes with joy. Joy comes from freedom, freedom to cultivate intimate relationships with each other, freedom to cultivate an intimate relationship with our Creator, and freedom to live out of his incredible love for us. So, Shabbat Shalom, happy Sukkot.